This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm honored to have as a guest a man I've admired for a long time, the incredible actor, director, Charles S. Dutton. We're going to talk about the recent passing of August Wilson. Rock, thanks so much for coming by to talk about this.
Thank you.
The first time I ever saw you on stage was in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And I mentioned before we got started, I briefly had a chance to talk to August a couple of years ago at the Aspen Comedy Festival. And the thing about all the plays of his, especially the ones I've seen you do, is they feel to me like, and I mentioned this to him, American Gothics, where there is a secret that has to sort of be dealt with. And so much of that is sort of this sort of rage in black families that can't get out because basically of racism. It's trapped in these households. How much of that feels like it's accurate to you?
Oh, I think it's very accurate. August never concerned himself in large measure to plot and structure. You know, and now there's some critics. Well, there's always been, but I'm sure there'll be a flood of critics now, white in particular, that will claim that he's not such a great playwright because the plays were too long, the plays didn't have the classic plot and structure and all that. But that was never his concern. First of all, he was a historian and a poet, number one. But he did, his plays did have that sense of a Gothic edge to them, that it was deeply about racism, about what that's done to us. And it was deeply about slavery.
And that racism being trapped basically in our community.
In our community and in our essence, you know, and how that informs our behavior, the way we deal with each other. And it was also about the lineage of slavery, the psychological lineage of slavery, how that's still filtered in our bloodstreams.
So much too. And I think of Seven Guitars, I think of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I think of these plays where there's a possession. The pianist, there's a possession that means so much. It takes on a totemic presence in the household. And so many times you were the person in these plays who owned this thing. I mean, in so many ways, his stuff felt to me, if you sort of took the Treasure of the Sierra Madre and made sort of that MacGuffin race as much as anything else, and the sort of desperation to keep this thing that has no meaning outside of this house, that felt like a big part of those plays to me too.
As an actor, there was an object you had to deal with, a piano, in the case of the piano lesson, this object, and which forced you to really suspend the disbelief of an audience. Because, like I said, this object meant nothing to anybody else outside of this house. But inside that house, it had to be the most important thing in their lives. Pro or con, save it or sell it. It was still the most important thing in their lives. That's how all the drama came, all the tragedy came, all the history came, you know, from their worship of that object. So his stuff has never been meant to have the traditional so-called methodology of how to write a straight play with a rise and fall. You know what I mean? He was a different kind of poet. All of the critics that catch that, I have to give them credit for it. From the early on, from Frank Rich to Michael Feingold, over the country, the regional theaters and everything, the critics that catch the message in August, what he was trying to do. And I say this a lot, and it upsets people, but just because you're an English actor doesn't mean you can do Shakespeare. And just because you're a black actor doesn't mean you can do August Wilson.
Talk to me, if you will, about your first meeting with him. Because what we're talking about, I just think about that amazing entrance you make in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Mm-hmm. And the thing about those, and I say Gothics too, because in Gothics, we think we know a character, and by the end we realize we don't know him at all. And that's definitely who you are in the plays you did with him. Tell me about your first meeting with him, the first time you saw him.
Oh, man, we first met in 1982 at the Eugene O'Neill National Playwrights Conference in Waterford, Connecticut. August had submitted Ma Rainey's Black Bottom to the conference that year, that summer, and was accepted. So when I first read the play, I said, who in the heck wrote this? Where's the guy that wrote this play? And I'm going to be honest, I was looking for a guy with a scar on his face, you know what I mean, after reading Ma Rainey. I said, this guy got a scar from here all the way down past his jugular vein. You know, he's been lucky all his life. And somebody pointed August Wilson out to me. And I said, man, that guy didn't write this play. Because, you know, August looked like an insurance salesman, you know what I mean? I said, that guy didn't write this play. And so August was actually looking for the same thing. August was saying, who's playing the character of Levy in Ma Rainey? What actors? And someone pointed me out to him.
Right.
And he said, oh, no. That's wrong. He's not the right guy for Levy. August's description of Levy was that he was a long, tall, lanky guy with an eggy-shaped head. And I've never been a long, tall, lanky guy, not even in 1982. So him and I was kind of looking at each other like, I said, man, you ain't write this. And he's looking at me like, man, you ain't right for Levy. I saw him do an actual rewrite in the theater while we were rehearsing and then handed, you know, they copied it and they handed it to the actors. And then when we were rehearsing, I saw in one scene, I saw him light up at what I was doing. And then he said, yeah, that's Levy. So from that point on, we became great friends. And Ma Rainey was a success that it was. And so our careers started together.
It's a treat. We're talking to Charles S. Dutton. We're talking about the late, great August Wilson. I've got to ask you this because one of the things I thought people kind of maybe put off by in his plays or embrace, but often put off by, were that sense of scale. I mean, that epic size and these epic emotions that are being wrestled with and the idea of seeing black men fighting like this mm-hmm. on stage had to be, for a lot of people, a very sort of discomforting thing, don't you think?
Oh, well, yeah. Some folks, you know, get a little queasy in an August Wilson play. I would imagine more whites than blacks, but for instance, just put the whites out for a side. Black folks would go see Ma Rainey and laugh for 2 hours, have a good time for 2 hours. But then the minute when Levy does that big speech where it gets into Greek tragedy, where he's opposing the gods and challenging the gods, black folks would get up and leave by the scores. The diehard Baptist Christians would get up and leave by the scores, and particularly on a Sunday matinee, you know? And then write me letters or write August letters, I mean, really vilifying us both. You know, mainly me, because I was the person that they were seeing doing
so
it. But they were like,
so
you know, they were going to wait outside for me with holy water and everything. And you know, the cleanse of my soul. But I used to, my reply to that was, had the folks stuck around to see what happens to the character right after that, they would have understood the play better. Because as soon as he does that, his life plummets.
But the thing is, though, he does that, and he's not forgiven. I mean, that kind of preachment, that thing that happened very often in his plays. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought this up, because I said the treasure of the Sierra Madre, because there's almost kind of an epic sense of pettiness sometimes in those plays. People wrestling, because it's not about that thing that they're fighting for, but about their own desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And Levy's desperation is a horrifying thing to see, finally.
Mm-hmm.
And that the fact that there's nothing that can save him.
Mm-hmm. Well, but you know, but yeah, there's nothing that can, absolutely nothing that can save him. His destiny is already cut out. But what unfolds, and this is another issue, but this is what I fear now that August is gone, that can happen to his plays. Because the genius in August Wilson's writing is that he writes a fine line between reality and farce. Any great playwright has some kind of fine line that the directors and actors have to tiptoe.
Well, because that scale, too, sort of makes it sort of blend into farce anyway, because it is so large.
Well, it's so large, but the farcical line is that once you step over into it, then August's plays can become actually derogatory about black people. He's the only major writer that still uses the word nigger all the time. Every one of his plays have major racial stereotypes in them. So if a director is insensitive, broadly intelligent enough, and if the actors aren't conscientious enough, wherefore earlier when I mentioned that just because you're a black actor doesn't mean you can do August Wilson.
Sure.
You have to be conscious of that fine line, totally conscious of that fine line. August actually sought to smash racial stereotypes, not perpetuate them in that fine line. So sometimes some August Wilson's plays that I've actually seen in regional theaters.
You've actually seen that thing happen?
I've seen that thing happen. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, take Piano Lesson, for instance. When August told me he was going to write that play for me, he said, "I'm writing a play for you." I said, "Well, what's it about?" He said, "Well, you know, about this, you know, August talked real funny. He was smoking one cigarette after another. You know, well, you know, I'm writing this play for you. You know, it's about this guy selling watermelons." And I said, "About a guy selling watermelons?" He said, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." I said, "August, you know." Now, we just finished doing Ma Rainey, where I've got a knife and cussing out God, and now he's going to do a play about a guy selling watermelon. I said, "August, you going to put a black man on stage selling watermelon?" "Yeah, yeah. He's trying to buy some land." But when it comes to us, watermelons is a racial stereotype.
Absolutely.
But just to the premise of this guy coming up from Mississippi to Pittsburgh with a truckload of watermelons to sell them, it encompassed the entire African-American experience just in that one premise. And so if a director chooses, I mean, there's so many things. Okay, they're selling watermelons. There's a scene about having tight shoes on. And then lo and behold, whoa, it's a ghost upstairs. You know? So if you're not careful with that stuff, it can become buffoonery. August has characters that are inherently funny, but you don't have to put anything on it. You don't have to shake your neck. You don't have to put your hands on your hips. You don't have to do any contemporary gesturing. The writing is comical genius. But I'm hoping in the future, 10 years from now, that his plays, being in the hands of other people, don't fall into Chitlin Circuit mentality.
That archetypal thing you're talking about, it was meant to be played with a sense of scale, because his plays, even though there was this sort of intimate melodrama, they were meant to be outsized. And I think they probably are diminished into stereotype if somebody's not dealing with the sort of scope that the plays demand.
Well, in other words, I like that. I like that when you said outsized, because that's what I meant about just because you're something, you can't do it. If you, the tendency when you're outsizing to be big, to meet the demands of the play, there's a tendency to really fall over the top into buffoonery. But that's why you have to be the kind of actor and the kind of director that can be able to do that. Now, August actually describes Levy as a buffoon. In his writings, he describes Levy as a buffoon, but a put-on buffoonery to understand the world in front of him. He's not an educated guy, Levy. But it's a buffoonery that he can actually maneuver the world, that he can understand it.
It's using these archetypes to comment. And it's that thing we're talking about the fact that, you know, there's this sort of horrible thing of race that we can't, those characters couldn't deal with, because in those eras, as he's moving through eras in the 20s and 30s and 40s, black people had to deal with black people.
Yes, yeah, sure.
We couldn't take it outside.
Sure, sure.
And that explains Levy, doesn't it?
Sure, sure. But also, too, Levy has been crippled by racism. Levy has been mentally crippled by it. And so within that, the character has to be played with a certain amount of imbalance. Levy has to be a little off. There's a certain amount of imbalance. And the reason he has to be man-childlike. And there's a reason for that, and it's a genius stroke on the part of August Wilson. Because if you play Levy as a big, strong man who can take care of himself, who can make his own decision and knows the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then guess what? In the end of the play, it's a murder instead of an act of passion.
We're going to take a break. That's a great point to stop. My guest is Charles Dutton. We're talking about August Wilson. Passed recently. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. My guest, who I'm thrilled is here, Charles Dutton. We're talking about August Wilson. We're talking about that sort of dangerous sort of line between archetype and stereotype. The thing about the Gothic that sort of you're talking about Levy and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom being a victim of that, there isn't everyone in those plays somebody who's a victim of that.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone
mm-hmm.
in those plays. Mm-hmm. And who's central to the conception of the play, and about how his, you know, that sort of that Mark of Cain, that racism leave the mm-hmm. left on people who couldn't deal with it, mm-hmm. who really lacked the self-awareness about mm-hmm. themselves
mm-hmm.
too,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
how that sort of destroyed everybody around them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for Wilson, it always seemed to me, race for him was what alcoholism was to O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
That thing that sort of...
Okay, great. That's great.
That thing that basically is the thing that sort of makes the...
Sure.
Because one person can't deal with it,
sure.
it damages everybody
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's what makes the play... The beauty of that, though, is that's what's so challenging about it. Something simple as a director making a choice, in the case of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and the character Levy, I've seen productions where the director or the actor chose to have the character have a switchblade as a knife instead of a pocket knife. Now, a pocket knife is a tool.
And implicitly carries no menace. Absolutely.
A switchblade means I'm looking to stick this in somebody.
It's a weapon.
And so I've seen productions that way, where he, a snap, he pulled. And that's what I mean. That's what I mean about the sensitivity. Levy is not that. He's a man child. He's had such deep pain in his life. And yet he's a musical genius. He is a musical genius. Yeah, does he have a grasp on the world? No, he doesn't. But he knows if he can make this music. And then he's derailed. But then all of that self-hatred, all of that thing, when the door is figuratively and literally slammed in his face, that transference of aggression turns right back around to his brother, to a black person. The question in the piano lesson where the character of Boy Willie, the difference between those two, they both have a big, huge zest for life, both characters, Levy and Boy Willie. Except for Boy Willie isn't dangerous. Although he's seen the same pain and understood the same pain as Levy, but he's found a way to handle it.
Well, that's the thing, too. By the way, we're talking to Charles Dutton. We're talking about the late August Wilson and the treatment. That's the thing, that he was creating those plays at the time that the modern version of that mm-hmm, Chitlin mm-hmm. circuit, which deals in nothing but stereotypes
yes,
and
yes.
the easy way out, and basically sort of the opportunist versus
right,
the
right.
The,
sure,
the church,
sure.
and it's the gospel mm-hmm. going to step in and save in time.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing in August's plays is that never people essentially weren't saved by God in those plays.
No, I love August's conflict with Christianity. But yet the conflict is an old conflict. Where was God when I needed him? You know, why me? Why us? And why them?
Sort of that epic pettiness I was talking about that's in those plays.
You know, but it's also very similar to Greek tragedy. And I don't believe August has never read a Greek play in his life. I really don't believe August.
No,
I know he hasn't read any Shakespeare. He's read Chekhov. Whom he really liked.
Oh, that's that object.
You know?
That's absolutely.
You know what I mean? But August has said he'd never read King Lear. I remember I told him at a tribute to him by the New Dramatist in New York a couple of years ago when they were giving him an award. And I said, Levy reminds me of King Lear, the extremes that he goes through. You know what I mean? And August said, oh, yeah, okay, I gotta read that play. I never read that, you know? And so what we have from a historical perspective now that he's gone, if a hip-hop generation person wants to really understand what a music recording studio exploitation was about, the only thing he or she has to do is read Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. You know what I mean? they'll understand what it's about.
It doesn't change.
You know? Right, absolutely. So if you want to know what was the temperature of black folks in the 50s when so-called integration was starting to pop in, you know what I mean? And the door was starting to open up a little bit and how their frustration was before that, then you just read Fences. That's the beauty of what he's left to.
Talking to Charles Dutton about the amazing work, the legacy left by August Wilson, you were just at the ceremony for the naming of the new, mm-hmm. the new theater, weren't you? Talk
yes.
about that for a little bit.
The renaming of the theater was very interesting because what I did was, once that Sunday when he was buried, that Saturday, and I left Sunday, I went back and reread all the plays, but this time in chronological order.
Had you not done it before?
I had never read it in chronological order before. Never read it in chronological order.
And what did you see?
Actually, I wasn't really looking for anything, but the sadness left me. in the reading of them all.
Why do you
think because
was?
I laughed and cried enough through them all. But when I finished, I wasn't really sad anymore. It was almost as if he said, you know, I don't particularly, as if August was saying, you know, I don't particularly like this call. You know what I mean? But if the call's got to come this way, you know, then I can lay back and say, well, okay. You know, I set out to do something and I did it, you know, and, you know, I was full with joy, man. All the plays became new to me. I really understood. I really saw the connection, and yet also the anguish of each decade. You know, going down a decade by decade. You can really put the 40 and 51 and see, wow, you know, there was a tiny measure of progress. Or, oh, no, things have fallen back. You know what I mean? I mean, you really see it now so clearly, you know. And I don't know if he ever intended it. You know, sometimes geniuses just do. And everything falls the way the critics and everything place this thing on it, and it is, but not that the person says, "Well, I'm going to write a decade by thing," but then I'm going to tie everything up to everything else, and it, you know, you just go and do it. And I think that was August. He just had it in him. It was his destiny to be that writer. So I don't think there was this major a forethought. I think he just really centered himself on an issue in a particular decade, because it wasn't until the middle of all this that he said, oh, I might as well do this.
So that was never the plan.
No, it was never really the pure plan. Okay. No. It never really was a pure plan. After, you know, one after another, he just said, well, let me, you know, it surprised me even when he said, wow, I'm putting these things in different decades. Let me just do one for every decade, you know. He never started off out with, as long as I knew him, since 1982, did he ever say to me that he was writing until three or four plays were out, and someone asked him about it, and he said, "Wow, okay, so I should do this." Sometimes he said, you know, there were actually happy divine accidents. You know, a lot of the piano lesson was written on napkins in restaurants and pieces of paper. He'd be in the Edison Hotel and his favorite hotel in New York, and he'd be in a restaurant and get an idea, and he'd start scribble scratching on a napkin and stuffing him into his pocket.
Hey, there's nothing else to do in the Edison but write stuff down. Believe me.
But the naming of the theater, the sadness left me. I wanted to do a character that him and I talked about, the character of Cutler in Ma Rainey. And when Cutler does his speech about Reverend Gates, that this old man was circled, you know, and that's the one I did. But there was it was lovely. It was, I mean, in Rocco Landisman's own words, the owner of the Drew Jamison Theater Group, in his own words, and I'm glad he said it because I was going to say it, was that there was an attempt, that this is finally an attempt to make the Great White Way a little less white.
Beautifully put. Beautifully put.
I like to talk about the week before that at his funeral in Pittsburgh. The saddest, but yes, most moving funeral service I've ever attended. I mean, it nearly brings tears to my eyes just to talk about it.
Okay, because, you know, basically, when I met him, he was sick, and he knew about it for a while. Mm-hmm. What was it like to sort of be, to talk to him, sort of knowing?
Well, you know what? I left him alone because it wasn't supposed to come out when it came out. It came out not in the way that he wanted it to come out. For me, I didn't know what to say. I also knew that he was being really overburdened and inundated by well wishers and calls, and it was sapping his energy to call folks back, and you know, so I left him alone. I didn't want to believe that it would be this soon from the announcement to, you know, the passing, But I guess, though, in classic August Wilson fashion, you know, he laid out the funeral, you know. He picked his own music, you know. He picked what monologues he wanted done. Well, of course he chose, he wanted me to do the death speech from Fences.
Oh.
About death ain't nothing but a fastball in the outside corner, you know. And he did, Ruben Santiago Hudson did something from about West Funeral Home, about being dead and in the casket and all that. And then Felicia Rashad did something from Aunt Esther. But I noticed that when his wife had said this is what, you know, they want to do, they were all, with the exception of the death ain't nothing, they were all sort of mild ones, but with an irony to them all. You know what I mean? And when I started, when I got up to do the death ain't nothing speech, and his casket is right there, although you would think that that's what someone would have done, you know, at his funeral, the death ain't nothing. But it, to me, I kind of laughed because I said to myself, "Oh man, you continue to amaze me." You know what I mean? You are something else. But it was a challenge because I had to challenge myself to get through it without breaking down emotionally. Because in the speech, Troy is very defiant at that moment. It's early in the play, the first 5 minutes in the play when he's making this big speech. But it was also, what he chose to do was, before the funeral procession to the cemetery, they rode through about 45 minutes through the Hill District of Pittsburgh before going to the cemetery. And so you got to see all of the places and the streets that he talked about in his plays. Elvis, people were in the streets, man, throngs of folks in the streets lined up blocks and blocks and blocks with placards and cards and newspaper articles and old women on porches waving their handkerchiefs. And it was just something to behold, something to behold.
Wow, you know? What a moment. We're out of time, Rock. Thanks so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Please come back and we'll talk about you next time.
Anytime.
It's a pleasure. Anytime, my guest is Charles Dutton. We're talking about the amazing legacy left by his collaborator and then good friend, August Wilson. Our technical director is Mario Diaz. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm proud to be here today. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents, hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.